Okay, greetings everybody once again. It's Brian Tarian and Peg Ball with this month's Disability Digest monthly conference. We got a super event planned for you here today. I've been doing these for a couple years, and I'll be candid with you, Peg. This is I've looked forward to this as much as I have any other conference, to be frank with you, because the work that you do is great. So what we're going to talk about today is how you can conquer limitations and overcome your concerns. And Peg is a professional coach for people with disabilities. She's been in this industry for a long time. We're going to talk more about Peg's experience in a moment. But really the key is here is Peg has been able to help people overcome limitations so that they can go on and, you know, find a way to supplement their income, start a business, increase their independence, which opens them up to a whole new spectrum of housing possibilities, and God knows what, you even help people sleep better. So you've done some amazing stuff. So thanks for taking the time to come out and spend a few minutes with us today.
Oh, Brian, thanks for the invitation. I'm really looking forward to this as well. I love what I do, and I love sharing it with folks. So thanks for the opportunity to do that.
Well, great. Great. So for those logged into the room, once again, I'll just repeat the housekeeping issues. All your lines are muted, so you can hear us, but we are not able to hear you at this time. If you do have a question, we're going to take questions at the end. There is a hand-raising feature that you can use on the little toolbar, the software that you logged in with. If you raise your hand, then we can provide you with the ability to speak to the group, or you can text us your message. If you have called in and you have not logged into the online room, you would need to do so you could ask your question. It's, again, the analogy that I used at the top of the call is you need to be logged into the classroom, which is the online part of it, even if you're using the phone to call in, so that you can ask the question. But at any rate, you're going to learn lots today, even if you can only listen to what we're going to go through here today. So scroll back up to this picture that you shared with us so that everybody can get an understanding of what we're looking at. This is, why don't you tell us who this is with you, Peg?
Okay, that's my service dog, De Niro, is with me in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
He's a 4-year-old lab mix, was trained by Assistance Dogs of America. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but it's a great service dog.
Great. Good. So here's what I'm excited to talk about. We've got, we're going to go through a variety of things in the time that we have, maybe chat for 35, 40 minutes about, you know, how people can reach their full potential. I want to ask you some questions about balanced disabilities and health needs, various ways people can increase their independence, how to manage energy so that you can get the most out of your day and maximize your efforts. You did say you would share some tips with us to help people sleep better. Disability and relationships, and responsibility issues. So we're going to cover a lot today. So again, thanks for joining us. So for the audience out there, I want to share with you Peg's background so that you can, understand who she is and the work that she has done, which has been magnificent. You've been working in this industry for 25 years, and you're certified. You're certified by the Coach Training Alliance in Boulder, Colorado. Correct?
Correct.
Great.
Great organization. Really good hands-on coach training they provided.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about what a coach is. You know, it's an obvious term, but we'll talk more about that later. But so most of the work from what you've done, what Peg has done, has been with Centers for Independent Living, which is a big part of how we help people here at the Disability Digest. And you've worked with centers in Michigan and Arizona. Your passion is for equal access, equal opportunity, personal development, and nurturing the spirit in each individual. Now, you co-chair... you're a co-chair on a board for Partners in Personal Assistance. That's a nonprofit. So you folks are dedicated to personal assistance services for people with disabilities and equitable work opportunities. Very cool.
Right. Organization started by folks who needed personal assistance and by some TAs who were working with them, and the idea was to work cooperatively for the benefit of both.
So the work that you're doing now, I mean, you're coaching people, clients, setting with goal setting and achievements. You're helping people identify where they're at, where they want to go, put together a plan to help them carry out the steps to get there, which is great. And so your specialty is working with our audience, people with disabilities and their family members and professionals. So one thing that I see that's not in here is you've done work for Voc Rehabs, actually, right?
Right.
So
several times a counselor will have a Voc Rehab client who's either working toward employment or working towards starting a business, and they just need some extra support in that process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to pull down the agenda here so the audience can follow along that's logged in. So really what you do now and what your claim to fame has become is, as I pull down the agenda, this is what we're going to talk about here today, folks that are in the room, is helping people focus on their abilities and their potential while honoring their disability and respecting their concerns. Now, I received a lot of comments, Peg, before we started today, and you know, there is, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but there's no magic pill, but there is the ability, and you've had great success in helping people, you know, overcome certain limitations, which is not necessarily going to take an a disabled person and put them back into an able-bodied situation, but what you've done is you've helped people get in a situation where they stand a better chance at getting a job or starting a business, or you've increased their mobility or their independence so they could open up to a new whole host of housing opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you make a really important point, Brian, that coaching doesn't change who we are. It doesn't make us more able than we were before, but what it does, what I do in working with people is help them to look at what are your abilities, where are you in your life. You know, the whole coaching process starts with assessing that. Where are you in your life? How does your particular disability affect you? What effects do you have on your ability to achieve your goals and dreams? And then we develop a plan to get past those barriers and to move forward. I think that everybody has the ability to accomplish some dreams in their lives, but we sometimes need some extra support or some extra creativity to help us get there.
Great. So how would this fit into helping somebody reach their full potential?
We all have different ideas about what independence means or what it means to be successful or what it means to reach our potential. So what I first like to do is find out from you what that picture is for you. What's the ideal and what do you want to accomplish in your life? Potential is a huge word, you know. I think that we all have a lot more potential to accomplish things in our lives than we ourselves are even aware of. And as a coach, I help you become more aware of what your capacity actually is. Sometimes our disability can feel like a barrier to everything in life, depending on where we're at mentally and emotionally with that. So part of coaching is help us see beyond those barriers to the possibilities and then develop a plan to get there. Along the way, I help you kind of monitor your progress. That includes asking really important and sometimes really difficult questions and challenging you to push yourself beyond what you might do without that extra encouragement and support.
So you would be a classic example of somebody that you know, is faced with a disability, but has found a way to leverage that into not only helping others and doing some work. And if that was your goal, then, you know, am I correct in that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, deep in my heart, Brian, I have a belief that whatever our disability, we can find ways to use its effects creatively. That doesn't mean that we sometimes aren't really frustrated or overwhelmed or pained by what goes on in our disability, but it means that we can also look to what special characteristics, what special insights has that disability given us, and how can we use those to move towards success.
Mm-hmm. Is there one glaring example that you could use, maybe a real-life situation that you've had?
Well, one of the examples in my own life is my disability, as you all can see from the picture, is a pretty significant physical disability. That means I don't get around very far, very fast. And I tend to be a person who likes to accomplish a lot and is real busy. And I know that if I did not have the physical limitations I have, I'd probably miss a lot of things in life because I'd be too busy doing and not sitting still enough and listening and watching and learning that way. So in part of my own professional development, I've looked at that and said, okay, I recognize about myself that I need to slow down, listen more, be aware of what's around me, and give myself the time I need to have the energy I need to do things. So that comes to that whole thing about balancing disability and health and balancing our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I've learned to slow down a little bit, and that's
mm-hmm.
been a real important piece.
Clever. Yeah, it does. You know, and these are just great pieces of advice for really for anybody. I mean, ideally for our audience, but anybody could certainly would benefit from that. So
mm-hmm.
let's talk about balance.
Mm-hmm.
Tips to balance disability and health needs. This is a key part mm-hmm. of your work.
Absolutely, and Brian, that starts with some awareness. And sometimes we need to raise that awareness in ourselves, but awareness of what are our abilities, whether they be unique ones or just everyday abilities, what are our limitations, how do they affect us, what are our health concerns, and how do we fit those into our daily life. Once we have that awareness, the next step is honoring what our needs are. In other words, things like arranging schedules so that we've got the needed rest breaks if our disability involves some fatigue factor. Scheduling and planning time to do the things we need. For a lot of us, it takes extra time, more time than the average able-bodied person, to accomplish basic life things. And so making sure that we don't cut ourselves short time-wise helps to kind of balance and make sure we've got the energy to do things. Also, for a lot of us, eating an appropriate diet is really, really important. I mean, health-wise in general, diet is a big issue. But oftentimes, we can identify specific nutrients or types of diets that support our disability-related issues or health needs. And we honor ourselves and our bodies by doing that, by finding that information and then implementing it in our lives.
Yeah, I know we've had a lot of work that we have done has been with, you know, nutrition and which has been an interesting one, but it can't be interesting now because food costs have gone up, but it certainly can.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly one can gain a slight edge by eating a well-balanced diet, and you can do mm-hmm. it affordably, too. I am confident of that.
Yep.
So,
and oftentimes certain supplements can be helpful with certain conditions as well.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of doing the research to find that out is a real helpful thing.
Yeah, I know. We actually had a seminar a while back that went over this topic, and we came up with some really good ideas about how to eat economically or how to eat healthy and economically on a disability budget. So there's a lot of good stuff. That's actually on our blog for those who are listening and interested in learning more. But let's move on. You know, one of the big challenges that I see that our members face is housing and accommodations, and it kind of ties into item number four that we're going to talk about today, which is independence, because from what I see, they go hand in hand. So oftentimes what happens when somebody becomes disabled is their accessibility needs change.
Mm-hmm.
And that affects their housing. And when you're living on a disability budget and trying to find affordable housing, I don't need to elaborate on this. Everybody knows it's a real challenge. So one of the things that really impresses me, what you've done, is you've been able to, help people increase their independence, which opens them up to a whole new spectrum, possibly, of places to live. So
mm-hmm.
Let's get into this one. This is a hot one. So tell us about that.
There's a couple of examples I wanted to talk about in this area, Brian, and the housing piece is certainly one of them. In looking at housing options, once you've kind of identified what your specific housing needs are, do I need something that's accessible? Do I need something that is chemically safe, chemically free for people with sensitivities. Once those issues are identified, the big challenge begins, whether it's finding rental housing or working on purchasing a home or a condo. There's certainly a lot of steps involved. And I think there are a lot of resources out there that the average person isn't aware of. By my work through the Centers for Independent Living, I've been able to find out a lot about funding that's out there to help people modify a home or an apartment, kind of what the rules are that go with that, and then, situations where somebody might be looking to purchase a home, what kinds of special programs are out there related to either buying a home and modifying it or getting assistance with down payment, that kind of thing. Certainly, it's not a simple process, but it's certainly a possible process. It took probably about a year and a half for myself and my partner to go through a process of identifying some support programs, purchasing a home, and then getting assistance to modify the bathroom, put a ramp on, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So having that experience, I know the frustrations, and I also have some good ideas about resources. And many of the resources that are available here in Southeast Michigan are available around the country. They're either federal programs or they're state programs that federal money comes through. So, what I like to do when somebody's looking at that option is help them, again, make a plan. What are all the pieces I need to put in place, and then coach them through the actual application process and, finding out what's available, what they're eligible for, and then moving forward with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It can happen, but getting housing, from what I've seen, you need to be, as I coach people, you need to be very polite and very persistent and use the fine work of those Centers for Independent Living, and it can be done. Let's dig into this a little bit deeper. You do a lot of work with service dogs, as you have a service dog, I believe what would be helpful for the audience to understand is some things that they might be able to use a service dog for that they might not be aware of.
Okay, absolutely. Well, service dogs can be incredibly versatile creatures. First of all, when somebody's thinking about a service dog, I like to help them assess whether they're actually what we call a dog person. Do they like dogs? Do they feel comfortable interacting with them? Do they feel like they could be a team member with a dog? And if the answer to that is yes, then you look at, what are those things that a dog might assist with? For those of us with mobility limitations, it could be things like picking up stuff that we drop, help with opening doors or pushing, you know, the buttons like to open power doors, reaching things, helping to handle transactions over counters. Sometimes for people who do have some mobility but who have maybe some balance issues or are just unsteady, they could use a dog to assist with that stability. There are certain harnesses that can be built to help the person actually lean on the dog a little bit. And, if, you know, certainly it would be a large and strong dog that would do that particular job. There are also seizure alert dogs for people with epilepsy, dogs that have that sensitivity to when there's a chemical change signaling a seizure coming on, and the dog can help them to be aware that that's happening, maybe to get to a safe place, lay down, or alert someone in their environment that that's going to happen so they don't freak out, you know, that kind of stuff. Dogs also can help people with chemical sensitivity. As a friend in Arizona who has a service dog trained to alert to when she's starting to get unstable because of her reaction to chemicals in the environment, and he's trying to get her out of the building right away to alert her and get her out so that she can get some fresh air and get restabilized. Hearing dogs, for folks who have deafness or are hard of hearing, dogs can alert them to if somebody's at the door, if something has changed in their environment, maybe their phone's ringing but they're not noticing the light flashing on it, the dog will bring them to the phone. Or if they have a baby or young child, the dog can let them know if the child is crying or something has changed. So there's a broad range of things dogs can be helpful with. And there are service dog training programs pretty much around the country and also around the world.
Peg, what about when one is interested in a service dog? Is it something that Medicare would cover? How does that work? Do you have to pay out of pocket for them?
There's going to be some costs, certainly, but most programs have some grant funding that covers a big part of the cost of the training of the dog.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. I worked with Assistance Dogs of America Incorporated. They're in northern Ohio. And with that program, there's a $25 application fee and then a $100 fee for equipment when you go through the training. So it's not a big expense, but then there's also the cost of going to the place for the training. Some programs train in your own town. Others you may have to go and stay. And at this particular program is about an hour from where I live, so I was able to commute back and forth for the 2 week training period.
Mm-hmm.
Some people actually stayed in a hotel during that time, so that would be a cost to you as well. And then the other thing to consider is, am I able to support a dog in an ongoing manner? Because there's not only food and, toys and that kind of stuff, but there's vet visits, and they can get costly, so it's certainly something that we need to plan for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you included some resources or recommended resources, right?
I listed Assistance Dogs there, and then there's an organization called International Association of Assistance Dog Partners.
Mm-hmm.
Both an advocacy and a resource organization. There are some good benefits to being a member of that. You get some discounts on dog things and a lot of really good information.
Did I just hear De Niro speak up in the background?
No.
I thought I heard a bark. Oh, must be my mind playing tricks on me. I was going to say he knows we're talking about him. Is it a he or she?
No.
He?
It's a he.
He?
Yep.
All right.
Laying right here next to me.
All right. Well, that's great. So the takeaway from this point is, for housing in general, there are strategies that you can do and design work stuff, plans that you can put in place that will allow you to get into accessible homes or modify your home to make it accessible, right?
Yeah.
And then just my thought is, on the second part, of course, that you can increase your independence, which would allow you, a whole host of different possible living possibilities with a service dog.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, certainly the biggest issue with housing, too, is also affordability. And there aren't enough good answers about that.
No.
But there are some answers out there, and some of them take some time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's move on to how to manage energy and maximize efforts. We talked a little bit about this at the top of the call, but what other tips do you have for people? I mean, I just know there's a lot of people that come through our site with autoimmune conditions, you know, especially like fibromyalgia and lupus. And some people are lucky if they get maybe two good days a week. What advice do you have?
Well, and certainly that is an important situation to address, Brian, that the situation where we don't have as many good days or as much time and energy as we'd like to accomplish things. And the first step in all that is evaluating what we do have. How do we use our time and energy right now? What's working, what's not working? What do we want to accomplish with the energy that we have? Along the way, there's going to be frustration, you know, and as a coach, one of the things that I try to offer my clients is some support around that and some acknowledgement that, yeah, some days it's really a pain, you know. But let's look at how you do use your time, what you want to accomplish. And then I always encourage people to be patient with ourselves in that process, because we're most likely going to make some mistakes in it along the way. But we're going to have some times when we thought we could do more than we actually were able to. But we've got to feel okay about that, recognize it, and honor what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, first thing is evaluating how we're using it.
Mm-hmm.
Then looking at our schedule and how can we manage that, those good days, and plan on those good days, to do the things we want to accomplish, but also plan on those bad days. Plan on giving ourselves the downtime that we need in between that activity so that we're ready for the next good day.
Mm. So great advice. So the first thing is accept the situation that you have. Play the hand that you've been dealt, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. And it's okay to be angry and frustrated about that sometimes when it's not the hand that you really want, you know?
Yeah. You know, we do a lot of work here helping people understand how to supplement their income, which I know you've done a bunch of as well. And the thing that I've seen is step one is to find something that is conducive to your disability that you know you can do.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people set themselves
mm-hmm.
up for failure right away. They go out and using our fibromyalgia example, they look to get a job that has them required to be somewhere at some, you know, certain hours every week. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
So
certain hours and certain physical tasks that maybe they could do 1 or 2 days in a row, but then 3 days and the next week and the next week is just too much.
Right.
And you're right, we do sometimes set ourselves up. And part of looking at evaluating how we use our energy and evaluating what our goals can be and should be, is looking at that really, really closely and with a real objective mind about, you know, okay, what, maybe this job sounds great, but does it really fit what my abilities are? And if it doesn't, then it's not a place where I'm going to serve myself or others very well.
Yeah. Great. Great stuff. Now, the next point that we're going to talk about is tips for a good night's sleep. But before we get, I'm just curious how you ended up. This is kind of this seems to me to be really like a specialty area, but there's so many people that are impacted by poor sleep patterns, and that just puts them into a tailspin to poor health. You can't sleep, you don't feel good, you wake up, you're in a fog. What, you know, how did you get into this? What happened?
Well, I have sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
And I was noticing before I was diagnosed, I was noticing that I was really tired a lot of the time. I mean, my disability has a fatigue aspect to it anyway, but this was a really big fatigue aspect. It was a really big sudden change. And though my disability progresses, for me, it's always been a very slow progression. So this really big tired thing came on pretty fast. I was having some headaches, not knowing what was going on. So got checked out, got tested, turned out I had sleep apnea. And so for me, that meant that my lung capacity, my breathing muscles, had weakened to the point that I was not breathing that night enough to get good oxygen, which then in turn, of course, meant that I wasn't sleeping well. So,
you've been there. This was started from your own experience, obviously, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, the medical profession, of course, immediately went to the implementation of breathing assistance equipment. So I want to talk about that a little bit in a minute, but I'd like to talk first about some other things that we need to look at in terms of getting good sleep, whether or not we have the diagnosis of sleep apnea. We need to have our body be ready to rest in the evening. Sometimes that means doing things like some stretches or some range of motion exercises, because that kind of releases some tension in our body. It releases endorphins, helps us to relax, and also helps to decrease any pain that we might be having. For some people, herbal relaxers like chamomile tea before bed are real helpful as well. And then looking at when do we sleep. A lot of our lives are affected by disabilities that affect our ability to consistent sleep. And consistent amount of sleep and consistent hours helps us to have a better body rhythm. Sometimes medication can help that. Sometimes herbal tea, like I mentioned, but to try to get some consistent sleep will help us to get good quality sleep. Does that make sense?
So before you do all you can do on your own, before you become reliant upon a machine, so like I actually practice one of those, not the chamomile, but I do stretch before I go to bed, and I've found that to be helpful. But I didn't do it because I thought it would help me sleep. So I just did it because, you know, it's a way I start and finish my day. But that's interesting. So that, and is there anything people can do from a food perspective? What about this whole, you know, eating a chocolate bar before you go to bed? And is that going to keep you wired?
I find that's a really, really individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people can eat chocolate or drink a cup of coffee, you know, have some caffeine before bed and still crash.
Mm-hmm.
For other people, they'll keep them up for hours and hours. So again, Brian, I think an important point here is that we need to know our own bodies and know what works for us. Sometimes that means a little bit of experimentation, and it's good to do that when we don't have a lot of big commitments the next day, you know. But it's good to check out different options and look at what does work for us. For some people, the stretching thing might be a pain thing, and it might not be the right thing to do before bed. So again, it's very individual. I encourage people to try things and know their own bodies, you know.
And would that
and then look for.
I'm just curious, would that be the same for, like, the time that you eat relative to when you go to bed? Would that be an individual thing as well?
Yeah, I believe it is. I mean, I think in general, our bodies are designed to process food when we're awake. So by going to sleep right after eating a lot, we can set ourselves up for some certain indigestion. And possible nightmares and that kind of thing. So, again, some people can eat before bed and be okay, but giving yourself a little bit of the time is going to be certainly being more respectful of your internal organs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk for a minute about some signs of sleep apnea, too. you know, if we feel like we're not getting good sleep, and we've done, you know, like you said, those things that we can to make sure that we're comfortable and relaxed and ready for sleep, and we're still not sleeping good, then there might be something more going on. If we find that we're sleepy in the daytime, irritable, have a headache in the morning, especially a headache that's more like around the back part of your head, if you wake up kind of out of breath, and here's another symptom that I was really surprised to learn, vivid nightmares are often a symptom of sleep apnea.
Wow.
When I first saw... Pardon?
That's interesting. I'm echoing it. That's a big wow for me.
Yeah, when I first was tested for sleep apnea, the doctor went through this whole interview, and one of the things was, you know, do I have very vivid nightmares? I said, well, yeah, I've been having a lot of those lately. Why? And he said that was another symptom, that evidently the decrease in oxygen in our brain causes that to happen.
Nothing to do with the thoughts before you go to bed. That was what I was of the understanding was an ingredient in nightmares.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this, you know, so the medicine, you know, there certainly could be a correlation with what you're thinking before bed if you're having nightmares, but in combination with some of these other symptoms, it's certainly something to look at in terms of a possibility of sleep apnea. If you're having those kinds of symptoms, your doctor should prescribe a sleep study at that point. And if you have a physician that's not interested or looking into it, certainly get another opinion. Because sleep apnea can be a very, very difficult condition on your whole life. I mean, not only in terms of the entire day of time, but not getting good oxygen in your sleep can have effects on your heart and all your systems in your body. So it's really important to get it diagnosed. But once it is, like I said earlier, doctors will usually want to do some intervention. That usually first means a CPAP. A CPAP stands for constant positive air pressure. And that's a little machine that helps to keep your airway open at night. A lot of times sleep apnea is caused by our airway muscles just relaxing and collapsing and blocking the air. And this machine helps to prevent that. If that machine is not working for a lot of us, this is true for me, the next step is called the BiPAP. That stands for bi-level positive air pressure. And instead of having just a constant flow, that gives you a stronger pressure to help you breathe in and a less pressure so you can breathe out without pushing against the positive air pressure there. And both machines take a little bit of getting used to, but once you do it, the increase in comfort and ability to sleep is so amazing. It's really great.
Excellent.
So, and Brian, I'd like to mention at this point, too, that I'm going to be starting a phone-based respiratory support group in January called Breathe Easy. And so if folks are concerned about either sleep apnea or other respiratory issues, I encourage you to email me and I can give you information on how to get involved in that group.
Breathe Easy. I like it. That's great. Well, that's good. So folks will be able to just call in and participate and get tips and support and understanding and connect with others, just like we're all doing here today. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. You know, disability in relationships is a really is a big thing, and you've done a lot of work with this. And you know what I see is that when somebody becomes disabled, I'm just thinking of their relationships with their loved ones become impacted. This is interesting. I'm anxious to hear what you have to say. So, What are some of the basics that you could give people for advice and tips of how, mm-hmm. you know, to really keep the relationships intact?
Okay. Well, I'd like to talk first of parent and child relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked a little bit with parents who have children with disabilities, and this actually first tip is really valid for other kinds of intimate relationships as well, and that is so important to keep that family relationship first and any caregiver relationship second to that. For example, taking a mother who has a child that has a lot of physical care needs, it's really easy for them to fall into the whole caregiver and patient kind of relationship rather than being mom and daughter or mom and son. So it's really important to find ways to make sure that first and primary relationship stays first. Sometimes that means hiring a part-time personal assistant to do some of that care so that the family member has a break, has time to interact with that child or that partner as a child or a partner, not as caregiver and co-receiver. So family relationship first, okay?
That's a great point.
We need to be who we are in our family and in our lives first, and then our disability comes second. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. I know that I'm sure there's so many parents out there that just struggle with taking care of, you know, the needs mm-hmm. of a child and get caught up in that and don't leave time for the fun stuff and the educational stuff
right.
and the stuff that creates that wonderful mm-hmm. bond. Yeah. Very cool.
And the stuff around making sure that the kids grow up with responsibility. I mean, children with disabilities need responsibilities and chores, just like their non-disabled siblings. And sometimes that means being creative in what kind of chores they can do. You know, how can they participate in the family in a productive way? Maybe for a kid with a physical disability, they might be able to tutor their siblings even though they can't take out the trash, you know? So looking for those creative ways is really important.
Oh, I see, because if they have everything done for them, we all know what that creates, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Total brat, right?
Okay.
Another challenge for parents is being aware of overprotectiveness, not sheltering that child so much from the world that they don't learn to manage in the real world. And at the same time, still teaching that child to make appropriate space in their life for their unique disability-related needs. So not being overprotective, but also being realistic about what their needs are and what their challenges and dangers are. Parents also need somebody to vent to sometimes or to brainstorm with. Sometimes that's other parents of kids with disabilities or support groups or sometimes a life coach.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that they can kind of brainstorm when they don't know what the next answer is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good tips. So that really is solid information. So for the adult segment of our audience and those that don't have children
mm-hmm.
that are disabled, what advice do you have?
Well, in terms of family of origin kind of relationships, there's similar things in terms of putting that relationship first. A lot of times for those of us who acquire a disability, have not grown up with it, there's a lot of education of family members and significant others about what that disability is like and how it affects us and how it affects the relationship if it does, you know. Unfortunately, a lot of partner relationships do not survive the onset of a new disability. But with the right kind of support, communication, and willingness to adjust their lives a little bit, there can be success in those relationships. Communication is absolutely the key to the beginning of any kind of success. we've got to be open with each other about our disability-related issues, how they affect intimacy. Sometimes those things are difficult to talk about, but they're really, really crucial to helping that relationship survive.
Well, I don't know what the statistic is, but the number of relationships for an adult onset disability that don't make it are just, they're staggering to me from just, mm-hmm. you know, the people that I talk to. So, what you're advocating and what's worked for you is to just sit down and say, hey, you know, this is how I feel, this is what it's like, and, right? Straight up.
Yeah, that's the first part. We also really need to be perceptive about and respectful of our significant other's needs in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
For example, so many times when we have, well, not necessarily just a new disability, but sometimes a lifelong disability, it's really easy to become dependent on that other person in our lives because they know us the best, they love us, they are there for us in so many ways. So it's really important that we recognize their needs for rest, time out, other assistance. Not everybody is by nature a good caregiver. And so it's really important to be open with our partner about whether they can and want to do any caregiving, or whether that's not something that they're interested in and we need to hire somebody else to do that. It's a really sensitive issue for some people. They say, you know what, never have your partner be your caregiver. Other people, their partner is their only caregiver. I don't want to say that there's an absolute either way, but it's really important that we be sensitive to each other and sensitive to how that might change over time and still make sure that that we let that be okay and not be the factor in whether this is the relationship we stay in or not.
Okay. This is great. So, first things first, I want to recap here, is communication. You got to be open with your partner, and you got to, first, what I'm understanding, Peg, is you want to find out what's important to your partner in the relationship, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
It's going to be a two-way street, as all communication is. So what's important to you, and then the next step is, well, just like we talked about at the top of the call, this is what I can do. Optimistically, if some of those can-dos can match up with what your partner's, you know, what's important for them, there's going to be some synergy there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I would expect that those are the ones that are likely going to make it. Those relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also to address the caregiver part. And if your partner doesn't want to be your caregiver, then you have to be willing to accept that.
Right. And if your partner does want to be your caregiver, there's still two other phases of that. How much of the time, depending on how much you need, you know, do they want to do part of it? Do they want to do most of it? And then being sensitive to if that changes over time, and making sure that they do get a break, that they don't feel like they're the only one that can be there for you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Super direction on this. Anything else on this topic that you can think of?
Not right now. Maybe somebody will have questions that we can address later.
Okay. Great. Okay. Before we start taking some questions, I want to cover one other topic, which is how to take control of the responsibility for someone's life. So you got to be responsible mm-hmm. for your own life. This goes back to our opening comment of, I believe, right? Play the heart, play the hand that you've been dealt,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, let's zero in on this.
Okay, you know, historically, Brian, people with disabilities have not been expected to take responsibility. We've been kind of taken care of. And certainly that's been with good intention on the part of the carers. However, it also has kept us kind of in a childlike state where we haven't had to be responsible for our own lives. So as we, as a minority, have become more vocal and more organized and more aware of our possibilities, we've gotten to the place where we want independence. And independence is actually the combination of some freedom and some responsibility. So along with that independence, that right to be involved in our community and go where we want to go and have accessible facilities available to us, comes that responsibility to be a good citizen, to be doing our part in our community, whether that's volunteer work or that's through our employment, or whether that's, you know, babysitting for our next door neighbor. The important thing about having that freedom is being willing to participate and see how we can contribute in the world. In terms of being in control of our own life, let's start with the decision that we know we can and we want to have that responsibility. And just like with some of the other coaching things we've talked about, we look at taking some baby steps, one step at a time. How do I become more independent in my community? Maybe that's learning how to ride the bus. Maybe that's learning how to drive for some folks. Looking for those places where our talents are needed in the community and how we can be involved is all part of that responsibility. Financial responsibility, learning to manage what resources we have, whether it's, you know, a small disability income or whether we have gotten to the place in our lives where we have some good employment income, that learning to manage those finances in a way that keeps us safe and healthy and contributes to those causes that are important to us is, again, a part of being responsible and being involved in our community.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that every decision that we make results in consequences of some kind. And so in trying to be responsible for ourselves, it's good to kind of anticipate what consequences an action will have and look toward doing those things in our lives that are going to have the outcomes that we want. Sometimes we can kind of thwart our own progress by doing things that, you know, set us back a little bit. Certainly that's going to happen to all of us at some time, but thinking about our actions and thinking about how they're going to either increase our independence and help us be responsible or whether they're going to set us back, it's real important to kind of look at that ahead. I'm a big advocate of planning ahead in our lives and being prepared for situations that come up. Again, that comes back to knowing ourselves and what our situations are and our abilities are.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Get active. I can sum it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Peg, you know what? I want to see if we could take a few questions in the few minutes that we have left here today, and then explain everybody a little bit more about your work. Now, for the audience that's listening, I see a few of you have some questions in the room. And so what I'm going to do, like Carl, I just gave you the ability to speak. So if you have a question, which you raised your hand and you did, then you can fire away, and as well as Mary Waterloo. You're welcome to ask your question at this time. So are either of you able to say hi or speak or tell us what your question is? Carl and Mary, are you there? Okay. Let's take a question from what I'll do is if you still have your question, you're welcome to raise your hand again, and then I will we'll bring you back in. So I have a few questions that were sent in and I want to address with you, Peg.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
here's a question from Renee. The limitations that she has is cost of living keeps going up, and it's really difficult. She needs help, you know, with cleaning, laundry, some basic stuff, so she can, you know, save some of her energy for other things. So it's a two-part question. So needs assistance with that, and also needs Section 8 to help pay the rent. What advice do you have?
Okay. First of all, in regards to getting the help that you need, first I want to encourage you and congratulate you for identifying that you need that assistance. The next step is, how do you go about finding it? If you need financial assistance to hire that person, there is probably a resource in your community, a state-based assistance, like a family assistance center or what used to be called the welfare office. Here in Michigan, we call it Department of Human Services. And they have programs that help low-income people to get some assistance with those kinds of things. Certainly, there's an evaluation process you have to go through, an application, and they look at your abilities and limitations and your income, and then let you know how much assistance you're eligible for. So say you've gotten that far, you've gotten the financial assistance in place, now you need to identify the person who's going to help you. You want to have a job description in place, know exactly what you need help with and kind of when you're going to want that person to be available. Go through the interview process. You're now an employer. You're a person who's going to hire somebody to do a job. So you need to think like an employer and identify, you know, advertise for candidates, have a good screening process. You want to interview them and make sure that you weed out the folks that don't match what you need or don't fit well with your personality, and then move on to hiring somebody. And I would encourage you to talk with your local Center for Independent Living or with a coach about how to get through that process if you haven't done it before, because it can be pretty overwhelming if you're doing it the first time. The Section 8 piece is a huge challenge because Section 8 organizations don't always have their application list open. So you need to find out when they're going to take applications, first of all, and then get that application in as quickly as possible as soon as the date opens so that you can be on that list. Unfortunately, some people wait for years, but it's good to keep on that list and make sure that they have current information of you, about you at all times. If you change your phone number, if you move, if anything changes, you want to report that immediately so that you stay in your place on the list. But when your name comes up, you can get that assistance.
Okay, good tips. Okay, we have some other questions that are coming in here. So I see that Renee has a question. So, Renee, if you'd speak up and let us know how what question you might have for Peg today. Are you there, Renee? All right. We'll check back with you in a minute. You're welcome to raise your hand again. I also see William has a question. William, can you hear me? Okay. For those of you, when you raise your hand, it gives you the ability to ask a question. So you can just speak up, and we'd be glad to address it for you. Let's take another question. I have a question from a member, Charles. He's been on a CPAP machine for 3 years, and he's just got a new one, and it really is not working for him. He's got a challenge getting acclimated to it. And his question simply is this. I mean, how long does it take you know, to get comfortable with a new machine? And are there any tips that you might have that could help him? He's not getting any sleep, and it's really a mess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a challenge. And the first thing I would say is get back in touch with your respiratory therapist and tell them that it's not working, because it might be a simple adjustment. in the pressure or a different kind of mask that would be helpful to you. Sometimes you have to experiment, but when you start with a new machine, if you've been on a machine before, there shouldn't be a very long adjustment period. You know, it should be supportive and helping you sleep better. So if it's not, definitely talk with the person that helped you to get the machine, respiratory therapist or with your pulmonary specialist, somebody that knows about the machine and can help you look at what's not working correctly. And sometimes there are certain machines that don't work right for certain people. Even though I use a BiPAP, which is a little different than a CPAP, as my needs have changed, the machine that I use has changed. And certainly one of the machines I used 5 years ago would not provide the kind of support I need now. So it might be that your machine's not matched to your needs, or it might need just some adjustment to that machine. Check it out, and don't be afraid to let them know that it's not working and that you need some help. And be assertive in that if they put you off, because you want to move it adjusted as quickly as possible.
Okay. Good tips. Hope that helps Charles get a better night's rest. Here's one from Linda. Linda's taking some college classes, and she's kind of stuck because she doesn't have the money to finish. And she can't get her loan written off. She can't get any more money. Really wants to finish her education for all the obvious reasons. Any tips?
Okay. Well, first thing I would suggest, Linda, if you haven't already done it, is to talk with your local vocational rehabilitation office. If you have a disability, they can assist you with college. Now, the funds, like all government agencies, are limited, but they are, first of all, obligated to help you identify and achieve an employment goal if you have a disability. So you certainly should apply for assistance with them, see what they can do in terms of helping you. Another thing I would suggest is do some web search for scholarships and other kinds of aid that are out there that aren't loan-based. So many times people take out a lot of college loans and then are really overwhelmed in their first few years of employment because all they're doing is paying back the loans. So there are scholarships out there for really unique categories of people, and it's really worth taking some time to do a search and see what's out there. Those would be my two biggest things to start with, I think.
Okay, good. Good. We have one from Mary that was typed in, which I can give you a break for a minute. I'd be glad to address it. So Mary's question is as follows. Mary's had FMS and CFS, fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, for over 20 years, and it's deteriorated a great deal in the past year, and Mary is working. Good for you, Mary. Hope to continue working, but would like to get a disability designation with SSI to protect myself. Is that feasible? From what I know, it's not. The SSI and SSDI are black and white. You either qualify for Social Security disability or you don't. And you would qualify if you are not able to do any job in the U.S. economic system 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, as well as a host of other criteria. And if you're working at this time, you would not. But what I would suggest, Mary, is this. If you sense that your condition is deteriorating, or because you've had it for 20 years, is I would certainly recommend that you take some preventative steps, which is consistent doctor visits. I'd keep a pain journal that documents your condition and how you feel and your energy levels, and if in some unfortunate set of circumstances your health changes, then you'll have a good solid history that can help you win your disability benefits in quick fashion. What really catches a lot of people off guard is they just are not prepared when they file. So that would be my best advice. So if you have something to, add to that, Peg, feel free, by all means.
The thing that comes to mind, Brian, other than those steps that you've already mentioned, is the possibility of a need for some kind of reasonable accommodation. If our condition changes and we're not able to keep up with the job, for example, maybe we still can do most of it, but there's a part of it that either requires more physical ability or is painful to accomplish, or maybe we can't quite do an 8-hour day, but we could do a 7-hour day. Looking at what kinds of changes in that situation would make it feasible for us to continue contributing both for our own financial gain and for the benefit of our employer, it's certainly worth approaching the employer to talk about accommodation issues and whether there are some things that could help you to continue being successful on that job without being overwhelmed and over-fatigued.
Great point. Excellent point. I also see Don Chapman, Kimberly Norton, and Nancy Karp have questions. However, if you could type them in the chat, that would be good. Or if you would raise your hand, I will give you the ability to speak. I'll see if I can do that. So either or. Oh, thank you, Nancy. Okay. Okay, Nancy, you now have the ability to speak.
Hello?
Hi, how are you?
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you.
Great.
My question is, I have been on Social Security disability since 2000. I suffer from RSD, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, plus fibromyalgia. I also have sleep apnea. A lot of issues going on. I find it difficult to even get out more than twice a week. I only earn $1,200 a month in Social Security income. That is not enough to live on. Where can I go to get a grant or more resources?
Well, I guess my first question, I'm sure Peggy might have one too, is what would you use a grant for? Because that likely determines where you'd go.
Yeah. I'm confused with that. I see a lot of advertisements for government grants, but I don't understand them, and a lot of them you have to invest money before they can give you the information.
Mm-hmm. Peg?
Well, one of the things about grants is they are time-limited, and they're a pot of money. They're not an ongoing source of income. So, for example, like Brian was saying, what would you use it for? There are grants for specific things like help to modify your house or start a business, but not as just an ongoing supportive income. So one of the things you might think about is what can I do to get some ongoing income? Maybe that is some home-based employment, or maybe starting a business. Sometimes there's great programs through the Social Security Administration called a PAS plan, or a plan for achieving self-support. And that's a plan that can help you kind of supplement your income while you're working on a goal to be more financially independent and any way to work your way off of benefits. For example, give a real life example. I worked with a woman who wanted to start her own business, and she was on disability, and so what we did was work together to develop a business plan and apply for the PASS program. And so in her case, the PASS program allowed her to keep her benefits longer while she got that business started. So for a while, she had benefits plus some income from the business. And then when the business got to a certain point where she was making more with the business than she was making out of disability, she was able to let go of the disability and have more income. And still it was a business that matched her abilities and limitations, so she wasn't damaging her health at the same time.
And you said to go to Social Security for that?
Well, if you look at the Social Security website, ssa.gov, and then look for CAS, that's all caps, CASS, or prostituting self-support, that'll talk about that program.
You know, another great resource is if you go into the members area for the Disability Digest, there's a great work that we've done in there with Andy Leaf, and he has a program. The title is How to Start a Business and Get the Government to Pay for It. And it's really, it talks about the PASS plan. He's helped a lot of people get passes, and it goes through it and explains it more in detail. But that's a great suggestion, Peg. And eventually from that site as well, you can link back to the PASS plan.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question. Thanks for joining.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Let's see. I know your time is limited, but can we take maybe one more question or so?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay. Kimberly Norton. Let's see here. Okay, Kimberly, you should be able to speak to us now. Can you hear us? Kimberly. Okay. If you're out there and still have a question, you have the ability to speak. Okay. Let me see if there's anyone else here. Carl and Don, I see that you have questions. If you want to type those into the chat box, we would still do our best to try to address those in the next few minutes. Okay. Let's do this. For sake of time, I want to just start to wrap up here and tell people a little bit more about, you know, your work and what you do and how they could, you know, learn more about, you know, the work that you do to get some help, because I'm sure they're going to want to know. So, first of all, you know, Peg does, for the audience that's out there, you work with people on even on an individual basis. I know you're starting a group in January, and you've done this through vocational rehabilitation, and you don't work for free. So just to let everybody know that if you want to work with Peg on a one-on-one basis to overcome some limitations, then there is a charge associated. Now, being the creative folks that we are, there are a lot of different ways that you can offset that expense. But before any expense is involved or determined, what really is important is to find out if you could help somebody. Right, Peg?
Absolutely, Ron.
So really the key here is we've set up and Peg has agreed to do a special for the audience, which is to meet for people with people for free, and really to set up and just sit down and chat via the phone to talk about how you could, you know, conquer your limitations, overcome your concerns, and how that would help you get a job, find a house, feel better, manage your relationships, whatever it might be. So, very nice of you to do that. I appreciate you doing that for the audience. So, to meet initially with Peg, there is no charge. And Peg will then determine if she can help you and then go through the various options from there. Okay? Did I miss anything there?
No, that's good. I think, you know, we're looking at a 20 to 30 minute session to kind of evaluate where you are and where you want to get to, and whether coaching is a good answer. And Brian, I appreciate you talking a little bit about the financial aspect of it. I'm excited to work with folks for free on their first session. Beyond that, because this is my business, I do need a charge, but we can look at what kinds of resources in your life might help you with that. I mentioned earlier that I work with folks through the vocational rehabilitation program, so that's one option. Sometimes people can build coaching into their PASS plan and other resources or other ideas. But basically the process, if you know, if we go through the assessment and you are interested in coaching and I feel like I can be of help and support to you, we would agree to a minimum of a 3-month series that we would meet by phone about 3 times a month. And it's your responsibility as the client to kind of set the agenda. In other words, I'll send you a preparation sheet that you can fill out and send back to me prior to each session that gives me an idea of what you've accomplished during that time, what you wanted to do but weren't able to do, and a little bit of an idea about what your focus for our next session is. So you're in the driver's seat. You are the one who determines what you want to do and ultimately decides on what actions you're going to take. I'm your cheerleader, your support along the way, and I help you to maybe identify those pieces that you're missing or look at the issues that are involved, and I help you identify resources that you need to accomplish your goals.
Mm-hmm. So again, the objective of the session, as it's up on the screen, is you'll identify some, usually 2 or more specific changes that one wants to make in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Brainstorm, strategize about, you know, ways in which you can make those changes, and identify how your disability or one's disability is limiting choices in their life, and strategies again to decrease those. So, very cool. So, that's great. Now, one thing that is really interesting, and I don't want to sound repetitive here, is that it is realistic, especially with a PASS plan or for a work plan through Volk Rehab to have training. I mean, this is why you were working with Volk Rehab. So to paint the picture, somebody would go to Volk Rehab and say, well, listen, you know what? I want to go back to work, and this is my plan to do so, but part of doing that is I'd like to get the assistance of a coach, and here's my coach, right? And that's how your relationship came about with Volk Rehab. So that's there's 2 different ways that people can get, really can get this taken care of, and you also have worked with people on a sliding scale. It's on a need base, which is very cool. So, but again, first things first is people need to find out if you can actually help them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
So let's talk about how one does that. If you're looking at the screen, it says contact Peg here, and Peg's email address is at the bottom. And if you're listening to this on the replay, then you scroll down to the bottom of the page where you listen to this, and you'll see Peg's email address. So when you email Peg, it is important that you include some helpful information, like what is the limitation that you would like to overcome, okay? And perhaps what, if anything, you have done to already overcome this. Right, Peg?
Mm-hmm.
And have you had any success with it? I mean, if you're trying to go back to work or trying to find a house, what have you already done? What's worked and what hasn't worked? And then, you know, your contact information. This is just Peg's email address, so you have to make sure you include those. And yes, it is a complimentary session, but I would expect, like anything else, is the better you do it explaining your situation, the better attention it's going to get. How'd I do? Did I miss anything, Peg?
One thing, Brian, I'd like to ask people to make sure that in the subject line of that email, you write coaching-disability-digest.
Okay.
So that I can pick those out of a pile of email real quickly and get back with people.
Okay. Okay, good. Good. Great. Great. Well, listen, I know we've gone slightly over in our time. You've been very generous to hang out with us, so I want to thank you for that and all the wonderful, priceless advice that you've just shared with us today. It's been fantastic. So
I've really enjoyed it, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate people's questions. I think it's so important that we be trying to personalize this information so that folks can really practically apply it in their life. So thanks for the opportunity to do that.
Well, you're very welcome. And in closing, I'll put up the other picture that you sent me today. See it on the screen there?
This is a picture of myself and my partner, and the arrow's kind of hiding there in the background, and we are visiting new friends in Kentucky. Got to meet their horse there, and he's a really sweet Arabian horse. I tend to really grab gravitate toward animals and horses, especially in my life, so I was pretty excited to have that opportunity.
Super. Super. Great. Well, listen, members of the Disability Digest and Peg, I want to thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time out today and, and coming by and participating in the conference. It's been a great event. So this will be recorded, and it will be circulated around in about a week. So if there's part of it that you missed or you want to replay or there's something in there, then you can download the MP3 or do the replay. So, again, thank you. And we will be having our next conference the first Wednesday in January. And we have another special guest that's set up for that one. So mark your calendars. So thanks again, everybody. Have a great day. Peg, thanks so much.
You
bet.
Thank you. Bye-bye.